The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Our first in the news briefing we're doing at Cafe Pino. This is part of the Aloud Business Forum, sponsored by the Library Foundation and made possible by the generosity of Wachovia. So our thanks to our sponsors for doing that. What we're doing with the series here is creating a storefront, if you will, for the library to bring the business community a little closer to us, and in doing so, help us raise money for a new technologies fund. So a small portion of the proceeds cover this sort of thing, and a larger chunk allows new technologies at the library. So thanks for coming. We want to focus on innovation, entrepreneurship, and business leadership. We have two great speakers today. Michael Kinsley is the author of the book Creative Capitalism. You can purchase the book afterwards right outside here. And Michael will be interviewed by Mark Lachter, who is the editor of the business section of LA Observed. Both are familiar people to us. Mark Lachter is a regular contributor to Los Angeles Magazine. He writes for Fast Company Magazine. I mentioned the LA Observed blog. He contributes to KPCC, and prior to that was the editor of the Los Angeles Business Journal. Michael Kinsley, welcome to the Los Angeles Public Library. He's a columnist for Time Magazine. For many years, he was the editor of the New Republic. He was founding editor of Slate, and many of us in Los Angeles remember him from when he had the editorial and opinion page of the Los Angeles Magazine. So I'm going to turn it over to Mark. Have fun for about 30 minutes, and then if there's questions from the audience, we'll all participate. Parking, the restaurant will validate it. I understand it is $6, and when on your way out, you can get that.
Thanks, Ted. Appreciate it. And welcome to LA.
Thanks.
And it's great to have you here, and my only regret is that we only have limited amounts of time and so much to talk about. I mean, it's scary stuff to talk about, but nevertheless, interesting times. I need to ask you first, before we get into the book, about the Tribune filing for bankruptcy.
Well, that was creative capitalism.
Yes.
not what Bill Gates had in mind, but I think Sam Zell has taken creative capitalism to a whole new level. If you read the statement he issued yesterday, he makes Chapter 11 sound like sort of a jacuzzi or something.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Yeah.
Something delightful you might want to loll in for a while.
And of course, the reality is that any kind of bankruptcy filing is a mess. It drags out for long, long time, and everything has to be approved by the judge, the bankruptcy judge, and not good.
No. And I was at the LA Times. I got in virtually the day it peaked at reputation and financially and everything. And as soon as I joined, it headed downhill. So you can blame me. I was the last person, as I was saying, to actually get someone to move from the New York Times to the LA Times. It seems hard to believe, but at that time, you know, that was quite easy. John Carroll had this great reputation and all these Pulitzers, and people were very eager to switch. That was one benchmark. And then also my first day there, there was the first sort of involuntary layoffs. So, and then it's been downhill since.
Now, Zell, of course, has been a lightning rod for journalists since he started this. It's amazing, actually. It's been less than a year, if you can imagine
since
that.
Since he officially
took. Tremendous lightning rod, and yet I do sometimes wonder whether some of the things that he has said about the newspaper business have been sort of pushed aside by journalists, you know, sort of the dark, dirty truth about the newspaper business not exactly being run very well in recent years.
Well, my friend Mickey Kaus, who does Kaus Files from out here, has been vicious and very funny a lot of time about the overstaffing question. And I do think there was a point where the LA Times was sort of ridiculous in the number of people it had. In fact, I will say that the editorial page, when I got there, had a staff of 15 people charged with producing 18 editorials a week. And so that was about one per person. And, you know, editorials are like, what, 400 words? It wasn't a great burden, and they all took it extremely badly if you ever suggested, you know, doing more.
So Zell had a point.
Yeah, well, except by the time he came, there had been wave upon wave of layoffs already.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would say he may have a tiny point. And the journalists can be very prickly, and that would be annoying to someone like Sam Zell, who is also very prickly, and he's prickly and rich, so he doesn't feel he should have
to give up. Prickly and rich wins out, I think.
Yes, and, well.
You know, it's sort of, and again, we don't want to dwell on this, but I'm just wondering about the online aspect, and it doesn't only relate to the LA Times, it relates to the entire industry, and the argument that the newspaper industry was way too late in trying to transition to an online business model that would work. Is there validity to that?
Or? Yeah, I think so. Bill Gates has a saying, which I'm sure I'll get wrong, it's something to the effect of, if you think in technology, if you think it's going to happen in 10 years, it will take a lot longer than that. If you think it's going to happen in 5 years, it'll happen a lot quicker. And newspapers 10 years ago, or actually more like 13 years ago, when I first got out to Redmond, before I started Slate, everyone in the news, that was the first panic of newspapers. They were all convinced that Microsoft, which had this site called Sidewalk, which was an LA Observe type site, except without any politics. So it was pretty bad. But they were convinced that this was going to put them out of business. And then when it didn't, they got overconfident again, and they totally missed the second wave with like things like Craigslist, which really have devastated them.
So it was way too late for, in terms of newspapers to you know, once they got in, by that time Craigslist had, I guess, taken hold.
Yeah. I wrote a piece for Harper's, like in 1980 or something, about Katharine Graham lobbying for laws to forbid anyone but newspapers to run classifieds. And they didn't get it, but it's a good thing for the world. Yep. Bad for newspapers.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the book, The Creative Capitalism, which has come out. I mean, to your point on this book tour, at certainly a very interesting time, as far as the business and financial world is concerned. But let me first ask you to talk about how it got started, because it's kind of an interesting genesis.
Well, Bill Gates gave this speech where he said that philanthropy can't do it all, government can't do it all. There are problems in the world that require free market capitalism to address them. And he said what's needed is what he called creative capitalism. Not entirely clear what he meant, but, you know, he said that. He said he wanted to start a discussion. So I thought, well, okay, I've been fired by the LA Times. I got some time on my hands. I'll start a discussion. And the book is that discussion. It's Simon and Schuster, I don't think, quite got it. The publishers, Diana, you won't feed that back to them. There is one conversation which are sort of in the traditional sense, which was Bill and Warren Buffett talking to each other, and it's sort of a transcript edited. All the rest of the book is email. And one of the things I learned at Slate was that email is sort of the only way you can overcome people's reluctance to read long things or write long things on a computer screen. And it's when it works, as I hope it does in this book, it is a great medium for discussing ideas. And I think it's something truly new. And on Slate, we called them diaries and exchanges. They were essentially blogs. The term didn't exist. And this book is, well, we're claiming it's the first. I doubt that. But anyway, it's one of the first, certainly, books to grow out of an email conversation. And, you know, all I did was I emailed the speech around saying, what do you think about this? And a few people took the bait and emailed me back. And then, you know, if someone said, gosh, I think what so-and-so said was ridiculous, you'd quickly email that to so-and-so. And then we set it up on a blog. And we ended up with a book.
Now, you had said in your introduction that one of the real mistakes you had made was to close off the blog. You needed a password to get in. Why don't you explain? Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, this was a lesson, I guess, well, I and maybe other people will have to learn again and again, which is that on the web, the right answer is always openness and transparency. And freedom in the sense of being free financially, not charging money. Yes, I thought, well, I'm trying to attract a lot of big shot economists, and they have large egos, so I'll close it off and I'll make it sort of cool to be a member to have a password. And that just didn't work, you know. Things were dribbling in. You had to beg people to write. Then I sort of one day I said to, you know, this colleague who was helping me, let's just forget about that. And we paid a lot of money to a firm to design our website. We threw all that away. We just did it on Blogger or TypePad or something. And said anyone who wants to can come in, and the thing took off because the economists' egos were wrapped up in being read. What they liked was colleagues, students would say to them, I saw your entry on creative capitalism. And so that, and you know, people were not going to go if they couldn't write themselves. So that opened up the floodgates and made it possible.
And you had some really good, very top-notch names. I mean, some of them actually are going to be in the administration. You had Larry Summers.
Yeah.
And who are some of the others who...
Well, we didn't have enough top-notch names for Simon & Schuster. I got into a sort of an argument. I don't know why I'm telling these tales out of school.
It's okay. It's just within this room. Yeah, it will never get out.
It's your skills and interviewer, Mark. How... I mean, you look at the book and you think Warren Buffett and Bill Gates wrote it. And I was very sensitive of not wanting to overly exploit them since they'd been very generous with their time. So we negotiated, and I think their names got about a quarter of an inch smaller. And if you look very carefully, you'll see other names, you know, sort of in the background, and those got a little bigger. Mm-hmm. But there aren't, well... Richard Posner, mm-hmm. Judge Posner, you're familiar with him. He's the only federal judge, except for the guy out here. who was had the pornography.
Yeah, Kaczynski.
Yeah, the two of them seem to have different rules than any other federal judges about when they will, what they will say and in public, and Posner's in there. Very good. He's a very interesting mind. He invented the whole school of law and economics, which that was good.
And if you go through the book, you'll see that it really is written. There's a certain blog style to it. The chapters are really quite short. The posts.
And it's not super organized. You know, it's more, that was on purpose. As they say, it's a feature, not a mistake. Because that's like email too. It sort of wanders around. And, you know, one day there was this comment by Larry Summers, who I'd been trying to get unsuccessfully. So I didn't worry a lot about where it might fit in. I just put it in. And so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the notion of the book, the notion of companies sort of expanding their responsibilities and their positioning. Talk about the timing book coming out at a time when the government is being brought in to, it seems like, take over the business world in a lot of ways. What about that? Do you?
Well, I was prepared for this. Well, or I was not prepared. Anyway, I knew it was coming. This question, you know, isn't your timing pretty bad? Because the book is sort of premised on the idea that capitalism is great and it has all this excess energy. That it needs to expand and take on problems that it hasn't addressed. And instead, as you say, the government, well, these are creative, this is creative capitalism, I suppose, but it's not what we had in mind. So everybody on this book tour I've been on has asked me, well, isn't your timing very bad? Then yesterday, Pat Morrison, I'm sure everyone here knows of her if they don't know her, she said, your timing was just terrific. And I sort of said, great, how so? and she said that obviously we need some form of creative capitalism now. So that's my line. But it is... I would have done this book today as opposed to 6 months ago? I don't think capitalism is disappearing.
Yeah, well,
I think we will have the same, and I don't think poverty in Africa is disappearing either. And I certainly don't think that the current crisis is going to solve some of the problems that Bill Gates wants to address. In fact, I think obviously the opposite. Those problems are going to get worse. So at least at some point, a year or two from now, people will want to turn once again to some of these solutions.
Yeah, you may be a few months early, but don't you think that after all of this stuff happens and we have a Carzar and we have goodness knows what else, there's going to be, when the dust settles, there's going to be some pretty fundamental restructurings of the way business is done, certainly the way financial business is done. Aren't we sort of headed for that? Or do you think that it's at some point when the recession is over, it'll kind of be business as usual?
It'll be business as usual, except for another overlay of something, regulations or something. I actually think that's sort of a danger. I'm enough of a free marketeer to be a little worried that some congressman, even as we speak, is thinking, well, if we're going to give money to the auto companies, we ought to make them do X. And, X could be some green requirement or any number of thing, or a high, you know, and some sort of hiring affirmative action thing. And even if I or most of us in this room approve of most of these things in the abstract, I think some of them we are not going to like at all. And even the ones we like, we're going to have doubts about whether another wave of government regulations is the best way to achieve them.
And of course, you also have a situation where you're in a crisis and fundamental decisions are being made in the context of a crisis and in the context of a time limit where, you know, you better come up with something.
Yeah, I mean, how many members of Congress had read the $700 billion financial bailout before they voted for it? And how many have read it even since then?
Yeah, and it does raise the question about the...
Had Paulson read it?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Since he changed his mind.
Yeah, it started as a page and a half and wound up, about 700 or 800 pages when the Senate finally got to it? The issue with the car companies, what's your take on this sort of scene last week where all of the executives were raked over the coals? The whole thing has sort of a surreal aspect to it in terms of...
Were you put off, by the way, the first time they were up, they didn't have a plan and they didn't feel apologetic and they weren't willing to mitigate their salaries. And then they came back and magically they felt passionately the opposite about all these things. I was influenced, probably excessively, by a hilarious review of the Cadillac Escalante, which ran in the Wall Street Journal last... it was the weekend before last, and had a great lead, which I'll bungle. Something like, in all my years reviewing cars, I have never been asked to review anything as absurd as the Cadillac Escalante. And, you know, it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid SUV, and it gets 20 miles a gallon. And I sort of read that and thought, well, these people are hopeless.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I grew up in Detroit, and when I was growing up, ordinary auto workers, you know, had cabins and boats and really led a great life. Mm-hmm. And it's it does bother me if that's going away. And does it really need to? And I don't have the answer.
Well,
I mean, the auto workers really overreached.
Well, I guess that's what I'm wondering about in terms of the changing of corporate cultures. I mean, you're really talking about kind of a wholesale reengineering of the way this industry has been running for 40 or 50 years. Is that realistic, do you think?
Well, you know, we're circling back, whether you realize or not, to newspapers. You know, the newspaper reporters had a pretty nice lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And no one is proposing to bail us out, although maybe that will come.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who gets... The question of who gets bailed out and who doesn't is an impossible one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of, again, getting back to the book, the one of the issues that's brought up in this idea of creative capitalism, the notion that companies need to do more than just the bottom line aspects of running the business. You get into this kind of Milton Friedman argument about, well, what about the shareholders? Is it really in the best interest of shareholders to come up with a bill of goods that goes above and beyond, you know, the bottom line, the earnings? maybe you can talk
about
that.
Yeah, well, Milton Friedman did not write this for us, needless to say. He's now unavailable. But he did write 30 years ago this very influential article in the New York Times, which Rick Wartzman last night found Peter Drucker's commentary on. Mm-hmm. Apparently, out there at Claremont, everything has to relate to Peter Drucker. But Milton Friedman said you know, that the social responsibility of corporations is to maximize profits for their shareholders, period. And then the shareholders are free to give away their money if they wish to. And he even said, as they should. And, you know, it's a little hard to argue that that's not right. However, one argument is, well, suppose the founding documents of the corporation, and this book is sort of, this is where it weaves into some very unexpected corners. What if the corporate charter or the incorporation or something or other says the purpose of this corporation is not just to maximize profits, we believe in serving the community? As in fact Google and Ben and Jerry's and some other corporations do say. At that point, isn't it perfectly okay for the corporation to do this? The stockholders are, it's transparency, you know, which is the great good of our time. Mm-hmm. You know, if the shareholders know what they're getting into when they buy the stock, if no one is forcing them to buy it, then what's wrong with that? Yeah. Well, that's a little unrealistic. I mean, most stocks of big companies are essentially owned by people who don't even know they own them. I mean, I don't
institutional
know.
Institutional
investors. Yes, or even mutual funds. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what stocks I own. So, but...
And of course, Google and Ben and Jerry's are very much the exceptions to the rule, because I mean, we can get into a whole discussion about the real estate meltdown and what caused that. But at the end of the day, so many of us are shareholders, are investors. We're looking for the best possible return because we need that money, and the details sometimes get lost in the shuffle, I think.
Even this legal discussion doesn't really answer the question, well, what should a corporation do? And, you know, you might well think, in fact, I think you would think it much more now than a few weeks ago, that you don't want the typical corporate executive deciding where your charitable contributions go. You want to decide that yourself, because they'll go to the ballet because the chairman's wife is a friend of someone who's on that board or stuff like
that.
So
it's like happenstance that some of this stuff gets.
Yeah.
And that's not great.
No.
Well, from your, you know, having had this experience of putting this book together, this is something I think you got into in Charlie Rose last week. Have your own opinions about capitalism changed a whole lot?
Well, not a whole lot. I would say on balance, I'm probably a bit more skeptical of this stuff. In fact, the book, I have had no feedback from Bill Gates. Haven't run into him at the supermarket, even though we live in the same city. I don't know what his reaction is. This book sort of by accident, what do you think? I think it came out sort of 51-49 against, which was not my intention, although there's nothing
wrong
with that.
No, it's certainly a nice balance. Yeah,
I think no one can accuse us of shilling for Bill.
Well, what happens, you know, looking at it more broadly, what are your thoughts about, I mean, if it's indeed possible to even look into the future, post-recession, post-whatever this is, how do you see the role of companies changing, or do you?
Well, one thing this is something I learned putting together the book, and maybe everybody else already knew it. Clearly, whether right or wrong, all the social pressure is toward corporate social responsibility, was the old term, creative capitalism. Corporations have to be more than just profit-maximizing instruments. You know, they just have to. Because if they want to hire kids out of college who are the best kids, don't want to work for a corporation that's just maximizing their profits. If they want to hold their heads up high at the golf course, you know, they've got to, all the social pressures, good and bad, are pushing corporations toward some form of do-goodism. Mm-hmm. Look at the change in Walmart over the past few years. Walmart was essentially like the current decade's equivalent of Microsoft. Everything it did, people dumped on. And they spent a lot of money changing things. They spent even more money bragging about how they changed things. And their image, I think, has changed or is changing. They had to do that. And there are probably a lot of conservatives who are cynical about that. And, you know, I'm sympathetic a bit to that.
You know, it's interesting. This is not exactly talking about community work, but healthcare coverage by companies was sort of an accident. It happened in, I guess, the 40s and 50s, and of course at that point it was so cheap that companies just kind of threw it in as a
It was World War II. That it was price controls. Mm-hmm. I think this is right, the only way you could give someone a raise was to throw in benefits, because mm-hmm. you couldn't actually raise their money. So healthcare became a standard benefit. Mm-hmm. And it's even now, I think they've mitigated this slightly, it's still the absurdity that if your company supplies your healthcare, it's tax-free. But if you don't have a job, you have to pay for it. You know.
Yeah, and it goes to, again, this sort of happenstance of if you happen to be working for a company that, as opposed to like a Walmart, in terms of the kinds of benefits you get, you're either lucky or you're not lucky. And, you know, I guess it gets to the issue of, in this discussion of what can a company do, how far should a company go? It depends. I guess some are going to do it and some aren't going to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering about how realistic it is to to attach all the requirements on a business to be, you know, shelling out this kind of money.
Well, one of the interesting little arguments in the book relates to it's several people bring it up, but this guy Clive Crook, who's an economic writer, spends a whole piece on this, pointing out that what Bill Gates is asking companies to do is something he did not do himself when he was building Microsoft. And you know, he's saying, do as I say, not as I do. What he did was operate quite aggressively as an old-fashioned capitalist. He built a great company. It did a lot of good in the uncreative capitalist way, the Adam Smith way, essentially, of turning greed and self-interest into the good of society. And I think Microsoft has done society a lot of good. Did Bill Gates in particular a lot of good? And he is now going to devote his life and his money to philanthropy. And Clive raises the question, well, maybe that's a better approach. You know, don't get hung up on being creative and doing good and saving the world. As part of capitalism, keep the two apart, and you will have an opportunity, if you're a successful capitalist, to be a successful philanthropist. Mm-hmm. And that's tempting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm neither, but but just this, it's part of the discussion. It's tempting.
We're gonna take a few questions in a sec, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, this world we live in is become sort of a crazy world, and one of the things that I'm finding is the difficulty of sort of moving forward and having an opinion about stuff based, given the fact that so many of our assumptions have been kind of pushed aside, you know, assumptions about companies too big to fail, assumptions about, you know, crazy deficits, $1 trillion deficits and so forth. And I'm curious as to your thoughts about that. I mean, how do you, when you sit down and do an essay, I mean, how do you, you know, how do you deal with the fact that so many of the notions that we sort of accepted over the years have kind of fallen apart?
Well, I don't know. Here's what I'm struggling with. Where's the catch? I wrote a piece about a year ago, which is now sort of completely out of date, against a fiscal stimulus. This was when they were talking about $150 billion or some infinitesimal amount.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, this is hair of the dog. You know, we ran up all these debts and had a great party, and now we're told that the solution is it's absolutely essential that we run up more debts and use the money to spend. You know, saving money or is just out. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've thought and I've written sort of four or five times, this can't, you know, this just sounds too easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe it. And actually, Clive, this guy we're talking about earlier, wrote a piece calling me a Sado-Keynesian. I don't know. I don't have the answer. But I can't believe that you know, that the answer is all pleasant stuff, mm-hmm. as it continues to be.
And I guess one of the real discomforts that we all have is we take a look at what the government is doing, Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, all the central banks, and they're throwing stuff at the problem, and so little seems to be working out. And it's, you know, I think in years past we looked upon the government in these kinds of situations as, you know, really bailing us out, not in terms of money, but in terms of mechanisms that could be implemented to make it better.
Well,
it's not happening.
Well, you know, it does. And when it isn't happening, they say, "Well, you got to do. It's got to be bigger." No one has ever gotten anywhere so far by saying, you know, I think $1 trillion is enough. No. If it's not working, we got to spend $2 trillion.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't have any real good argument why that's wrong, but it makes me nervous. You know, that we're going to end up, you know, in a year from now, with an extra $1 trillion on the national debt and nothing to show.
Yeah. What
for.
Did we do? How could this happen? Well, let's open it up to some questions that you might have for Michael, since we just have a few minutes, and I'm sure he's willing to talk about anything.
Sure.
LA Times.
anything.
Brady. You
Well, since I don't know, I'm hardly qualified to answer that. I'll answer it in two ways. One is, the collapse of manufacturing, maybe I'm wrong, just does not bother me. You know, people would have said the same thing about farming 100 years ago. How can an economy operate without the basic foodstuffs that keep us growing? You know, and we've done very well with farming down to 1% or 2% of GDP. And I don't see any logical reason why manufacturing should be any different. And then the second thing is a question, since you seem to know a bit more about this than me, and it concerns China. I'm puzzled whether, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we were all petrified about Japan. And Japan was going to, had discovered a new form of capitalism. Actually, it's very similar. And we can't compete with them in the normal ways. And this makes free trade obsolete. And all that turned out not to be true. There was nothing special about Japan. They've had a terrible decade. And, you know, they will be a competitor, but we will benefit in the long run from having prosperous people to trade with in the classic Adam Smith sense regarding Japan. Now, China, maybe I'm getting older or something, but it is a little eerie how everything seems to come from China. So I would like you to reassure me that China will turn out to be just like Japan, or tell me that I ought to worry. I'll take either one.
Well, I think China is now moving up to where Japan was, and Vietnam and those other countries.
China was, yeah.
So I think in the long run.
Yeah, but Japan.
The change in our economy is being forced as its horrible short term effect. In the long term, we may get to decide where we need people with more knowledge based economy as opposed to people who are seeing manufacturers. In the long run, it's going to be beneficial.
Oh, well, sounds like we're close to agreement.
Yeah.
I'd like to stay with that analogy you made between manufacturing and farming. Uh-huh. With the subsidies that the federal government is very large and litigated or discussed by Congress since their inception, maybe 30 years ago, aren't they really propping up the farming sector so we do have, you know, both an international and domestic, you know, market? Should subsidies go further, possibly in the next multi-trillion-dollar bailout in manufacturing? Maybe that's the way to use that model again for manufacturing.
You're saying that the subsidies have worked out in farming?
Maybe not politically, and maybe not, you know.
I'll tell you a story. They clearly worked out politically. Whether they actually make sense, I don't think so. I got on a plane once in Indianapolis, and I looked at the seat next to me, and there was Richard Lugar, very distinguished senator, you know, one of the real high-minded class acts in the Senate, everybody thinks. And I think they're right. I introduced myself, and we were talking, and he pulls out this big thing, and it was 1982, and it was the Farm Bill, which comes up every 5 years. And 1982 was the year. And he spent the entire plane ride inveighing against it, how stupid it was, how ridiculous, how unfair to subsidize rich farmers while, you know, poor people don't get it. And how it's how unfair it is to the third world, you know, not letting them sell their goods here. And I got off that plane thinking Richard Lugar is terrific. And then I said this to somebody, and he said, you know, he voted for the Farm Bill. and you know, you can't blame him for that. Because he's from Indiana, he had to get elected. But that's the power of the farms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can it apply to manufacturing? Can we, use the bailout, the next one, in subsidies?
Actually, it's one of the things Paulson seems to be learning. Every wave, every time he revises the bailout, which he seems to do about once a week, it's more along the lines of why don't we just subsidize these people?
That's scary.
Yeah. And pardon me?
That is what's scary.
Yeah. And so I suppose you could do that with cars. Just say, look, anyone who buys the Cadillac Escalante can get $1,000 from the government.
Yeah.
But I don't think that would work.
It's you know, to your point, it's the direction that we seem to be. Everybody's talking more and more about, well, Somebody was saying the other day on one of the talk shows, well, why don't we just nationalize, whether it was the car industry, it was something, some big industry in trouble. And you're hearing more and more of that. I mean, it's the sort of thing that a year or two, I mean, could you even imagine that people would be talking about the notion of nationalization of any industry?
Well, if it happens, it'll happen the way it's happening, which is it won't be liberal Democrats sort of making a decision, a considered, if mistaken, decision, you know, based on their ideology. It will be Republicans sort of doing it over the weekend without anyone noticing and without their really even being aware of what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
The future of the American newspaper. Well, who knows? I think, here's my best guess, A, it will certainly be online. I think the LA Times in its prime was a great example of the stupidity of newspapers on paper. You know, you would get that stack tied with a string, and you'd spend half an hour sorting through it. And to get that stack to you, you know, trees are chopped down.
And it's old.
Yes,
it's old.
And they're lugged, you know, halfway across the country and turning in huge rolls of newsprint. I mean, it's a classic 19th century industrial process. And that's nuts. And you're right that the failure of newspapers to recognize that early on was certainly one of their key mistakes. What will replace it? It will be something on the spectrum from shovelware, you know, just what was the paper, only not on paper, but articles written by journalists who got paid in the traditional way. That's at one extreme. And the other extreme is, you know, my friend Mickey sitting in his boxer shorts in Venice, you know, just surfing the web and writing opinions. And I had thought that it would be the first thing, and I'm being dragged like everybody else by events and technology faster than we all are, faster than we intended. So I'm now moving toward the second view. And I think a model might be the British newspapers, which do not separate fact from opinion, as you know. They make no pretense at being objective. But, you know, someone who reads the FT or the Guardian every day is very well informed. And I would happily settle for that as a standard to preserve democracy. You know, if every kid grew up able to read and digest the FT, we would have a pretty good, thriving democracy. So I think it's, well, the difficulty is, will anyone get paid?
I mean, that is a slight complication.
Yeah, and I don't know, but it's not going to be a bunch of articles written by you and me with bylines and paychecks and all that. It will be something, you know, in between that and Mickey in his boxer shorts.
Time for one more question, I think. Yeah.
Going back to all the bailout and the trillions of dollars that are being thrown at the problem, two questions. where is all of that money going to come from, and are we staring double-digit inflation right in the eye again?
Well, your first question is my question, and the answer people say is, oh, it's okay to print it this time for reasons I'm trying to grasp. They say you can run the printing presses to get yourself out of this mess. So the answer to your second question is you're absolutely right. I think we're going to have another bout of 70s style inflation. That's the only way I can see that this debt we're running up is going to get paid off. And what you can do about that as an individual, I don't know.
Take out those, whip inflation now button?
Oh,
remember those?
Yeah.
From the 70s?
When?
Well, this has been great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
I appreciate it. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for coming. The books are available, and Michael will sign them before he heads to the airport.
Or won't, whichever you prefer.
Those of you who are not subscribers and might be interested in subscribing to our series, please talk to me. I'll be happy to help you. And thanks again. Our next event is January 14th with John Zogby, and on the 29th with Sir Ken Robinson on creativity and business.
Can you check the book out of the library? Yeah.
Ten copies of the book will go into the library tomorrow.
Great. Tomorrow. Thanks.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.